Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is June 26th, 2006. Our session today is entitled A Forum, Waging Peace, How Do We Build a Peaceful Planet in a Time of Terror? Our presenter is John Marty. Session number FO 2006-4. Let's listen in.
The way I always see the way that our country could respond, since we can't speak for the rest of the world, Nellie Van Doren's session right before Vespers tonight was talking a lot about Christian Islamic dialogue and how we can try and build a more peaceful world that way. And I think that that's very much one of the approaches we can do. We can take the military approach. If there are these terrorists, it's sort of what the U.S. has decided now. We've got a war on terror, and we're going to crush them like ants. Whatever it takes, we're going to go after them. And we build the biggest, most awesome military in the world and best military technology, and we're going to beat them in a war. The second approach is the, I would suggest, is the almost the opposite. It's the nonviolent conflict resolution, which is not safe from violence. Most nonviolent movements in the world against bad forces over the years have been subject to many deaths themselves. Most of them have not cost the same millions of lives that some of our wars have cost, but they're not fun, pleasant places to be, and lots of people die in the process. As the CPT, the Christian Peacemaker team, Tom Fox, who died in Iraq a couple months ago, did. But part of it's a nonviolent conflict risk.
Excuse me, you better stand up. There's a mouse running up your leg.
You feel something running up my leg. Thank you. When you said that, I said, huh? And I felt something running down my leg.
Such a pattern.
I don't have any food in here that I know of. Thank you, Jen. I didn't particularly. I don't like mice crawling up my legs. It's a new one to me.
Only at Holden.
Yeah, only at Holden. Probably slip over backwards.
It's just an ice cream.
Yeah. On that note, winning hearts and minds is the other part of what I'd argue is the alternative to war. It's not only finding ways to bring two sides together, again, the Christian-Islamic dialogue that Nellie was talking about, but also the winning hearts and minds of people. The Peace Corps was an attempt to do that 40, 50 years ago. But first, let's take a look at what's happening with the military approach. Our Department of Defense, once Department of War, is far and away the most potent in the world since the Cold War, where we had a slight advantage till now when there's no second place to us. We just dominate it, and we're spending, $500 billion a year if you count the Iraq War. We rank very low, contrary to what some people would think, very low in terms of economic aid to other countries for development and anything other than military. Our military aid, which we may be number one, I'm sure we're number one in military aid as well, that and arms sales to countries, often countries fighting against each other, highly sophisticated weapons, which at times, like in Iraq and so on, may actually get used against us at a later time, but we sell weapons overseas, whether that's considered part of our military approach or just simply money making, I'm not sure, but the question is, are we making the world safer, more peaceful, since that's what our purpose for the discussion is. And since 5 years ago when the world reached out to us after September 11th, we are now in a situation where most of the world is angry at us. And I think people traveling in other countries are often not sure they want to tell people they're American these days, which is a thing that's quite a change from 40 or 50 years ago and a significant change even from 5 years ago. But it was last 2-3 weeks ago in Newsweek, there were a couple comments on things that may have something to do with the way the world views us, again related to our military. We spent hundreds of billions of dollars on this war that we don't know how to get out of. we've strained our military, and many people would say that perhaps it's inevitable in war, but there are tragic, deadly errors, and there are soldiers who snap under pressure. And Newsweek, in an article on probing a bloodbath, talked about, they interviewed some conscientious objectors from the military who were in Baghdad and who came home as objectors, one of them by the name of Clifford Hicks. We're killing the wrong people all the time, and mostly by accident. One guy in my squadron ran over a family with his tanks. Hicks's own revulsion peaked while he was on patrol in January 2004, came across a bloody scene in a Baghdad housing project where some soldiers had mistaken celebratory shots fired at a wedding for an attack, returning heavy fire and killing a young girl. I looked in the door and she was dead, shot through the neck. Mom there, grandma there, all losing it. Then I started thinking, this is really effed up. This is horribly wrong. Hicks stopped taking his malaria pills, hoping he'd get sick and shipped out. But then the same article talks about one that's was not unintentional, but the way it sounds, the criminal charge is likely to be filed. The saddest and ugliest story was told to a Newsweek reporter by a 12-year-old girl named Safa Yunus. And this was about the Hadatha attacks last November. When the Marines entered her house that morning, she fled with her mother into a bathroom. A soldier followed them, shooting, she says. The soldiers left. Safa tried to talk to her mother, but she was covered in blood. Mama, mama, cried the girl until she realized her mother was dead. So was her father, whom she found lying near the kitchen door, and her aunt and her five siblings, all shot to death. I was sorry for staying in the bathroom. I should have died with them, recalls Safa, who now lives with a cousin. The Americans are murderers, criminals. They have no mercy. And I think many of us wonder if for every terrorist we kill, we are creating three or four new ones. It's not winning hearts and minds, certainly. And I think many people, there was not an Al-Qaeda presence in Iraq of any significance before the war. There now is. So turn to the alternative, hearts and minds and nonviolent conflict resolution. First thing we could do that doesn't cost us anything other than some business is stop selling the arms. The arms are being used by two sides to create war that one side turns against us at some point, and then we've got a bigger problem. Nonviolent intervention, we always talk about how lots of people dismiss it as not something that works. Of course, how do you stand up to Hitler with nonviolence? It's a classic case. I talked about this the other evening in a talk. But Ron Sider, theologian, asked how Christians in the just war tradition of Augustine, which talks about last resort, how can Christians in the just war tradition claim that the violence they justify is truly a last resort until they've invested billions of dollars and trained tens of thousands of people in a powerful, sustained testing the possibilities of nonviolent alternatives? If we spend $500 billion a year in military, shouldn't we be spending at least a good chunk of that in terms of alternatives before we say war is our last resort, we have to do it? And also, there are plenty of examples of it that work. We keep forgetting about it. We point to Martin Luther King and the civil rights movement, which did work, and it was against violence. And again, plenty of people died in the process by returning violence with nonviolence, but it worked. Mahatma Gandhi's overthrow of the British Empire, Ferdinand Marcos in the Philippines, one of the most impressive ones, where the cardinal is telling the people, go outside and stand up to the tanks, stand up to the military, and people did, and basically bloodless, 100-some lives, overturning the Marcos regime. And there are plenty of others, Poland Solidarity Movement, after the fall of the Iron Curtain, most of those were nonviolent revolutions. Turning over things. Tiananmen Square is one that we think of as how futile it is. And it was futile for the people. They were killed in the process, but in Moscow, a couple of years later, it was successful, where they stood on the tanks and they dared the soldiers to go after them. I mean, they didn't dare them. They stood up to them and urged them not to. And these were successful battles. Winning hearts and minds not only means not killing people, but it also means Peace Corps type of efforts, providing assistance. When Nellie, in her talk right before the session, was talking about how do the Palestinian Christians reach out in a country where they are less than 2% of the population, she said, They run hospitals, they run schools, they are doing things to reach out to the other side. That's the whole way you win hearts and minds. No matter how hard you try, this Newsweek article talked about our military is still the best trained in the world and the least likely to commit massacres, the least likely to do other things, or at least it was. I think it's inevitable, though, that you're going to have tragedies. And the more we can do the response, as Nellie pointed out, with the hospitals and the schools, the more we might turn things around. Because frankly, the Islamic fundamentalists in a lot of countries in Pakistan after the earthquake, they're the ones who are providing the assistance. And when people are in the cold, when they have nothing, people who help them tend to become their friends. So my suggestion is that we look, as I open this up for discussion, is the approaches that I think have the most promise are things we have to do both of. We probably have to do all these things, but one is the nonviolent response to conflict, and that means serious, not rhetoric about, well, we tried, we gave them this ultimatum and they didn't do it, and we know they have weapons of mass destruction, so we're going in. But trying every alternative, if war is a last resort, it should be a last resort, not something because we're kind of eager and trigger happy. And then number two, the working with friendship and trust in building friends in the world instead of creating enemies. But this is supposed to be a discussion, a dialogue, and I'm laying that out as a framework for maybe how we look at alternatives to peace. And some people may feel the military is the way to go. I think we should talk about what people are thinking. So who wants to kick it off? Any thoughts? Way in the back. Yes?
My impression was that our military are providing schools and the hospitals and the like. You didn't mention that.
Right. I did not mention it because it's getting drowned out by what is happening. Yeah, the Peace Corps is going too. I mean, we've got lots of efforts that we're doing.
I don't mean the Peace Corps. I mean the...
Yeah, I understand. I understand. The soldiers are building. We were supposed to devote $18 billion to rebuilding Iraq.
Right.
Over a period of time, and that $18 billion isn't all spent yet. There are some good things happening.
Okay.
The trouble is, for every one good thing, you've got to remember the other side does not like us, and they do everything they can to play up all the awful stuff. And anybody, I mean, you can build a school for a community and help facilitate health care for a community, and you go in and gun down innocent people accidentally or otherwise, and somehow you might create some possible friends, but on the other side you're creating people when a child watches their parents die in front of them, you're almost certainly creating hatred. And so yes, I think you're exactly right. We gotta point out that there are good things happening.
Right.
So it's a good point.
You would think that at least our side would be mentioning the good things we're doing rather than
right. I didn't focus on lots of other good things that are happening too. In terms of dollar amount, we're heavily focused on the one end and not the other. But yes.
Yeah, we're building schools, but I've spoken with, an Iraqi woman, and the kids, the Iraqi parents, especially around Baghdad, that they won't send their kids to school because they're afraid for that many people to be in one place.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, kids aren't going to school in Iraq. They're staying at home because their parents don't want them out of the house. They don't go outside to play. They're not because of the fear of, you know, whether they're intentionally killed or whether it's crossfire or what. It's just too dangerous to be out. So, you know, at the moment, it's not doing so much good.
It's not a very stable country right now, and there are some attempts to rebuild. Again, we're in a world where you can say, oh, the other side should abide by certain rules, which we should too. But again, during the Revolutionary War, the British were thinking our folks didn't play fair. They shot from behind rocks while they stood up. Well, we can say they shouldn't do this, but we rebuild something and they destroy infrastructure too. So we have to realize that what we've got out there is a world, a lot of people who hate what we do, and how do you build that dialogue?
So what do we do now? How do we get out of it?
Good questions. One of the things we should talk about.
Mm-hmm.
So who wants to either go on make a response to that?
What do we do?
I have some feelings about how I would do some things, but let's welcome.
I'm really concerned with the ongoing sort of go it alone attitude in terms of foreign policy in our country. I think there are incredible opportunities now to be making some headway with Iran, regardless of what we feel about the nuclear policy, but to shun opportunities to partner with other countries is very worrisome. And
we are very much isolationist in our policies. At the same time, we're intervening all over the world. Yeah, the UN is not something we talk about as an ally. We talk about, a lot of our leaders talk about them as an interference with things.
The United States had some, I hesitate to use the word successes, but some successes with overwhelming military might in winning World War II and rebuilding Germany, and winning World War II and rebuilding Japan. But all of a sudden we're in a situation that we aren't the first to be in a situation where the overwhelming military might doesn't make it. It doesn't cut it. The Russians failed in Afghanistan. The French, and to a certain extent the U.S., failed in Vietnam. And it's kind of on and on and on. With this kind of guerrilla tactics, we just don't know how to do that. So I guess my question is, so failing that, what haven't we tried? And what might we do? Because it's obvious that we aren't, I think it's becoming obvious that we aren't being very successful, even with close to trillions of dollars being spent on this effort, we aren't being successful. So what else can we do?
Do we talk to the insurgents? Is there any talking to them about what we...
There are certain, I mean, I don't know all the inside of what's going on, but there are people who do talk
to them,
trying to reach out to people, but it's not very easy to do when...
No, I know.
But on that point about the overwhelming military force, I think one of the things that egged on a lot of the military leaders in our country, most of whom didn't fight in the Vietnam War themselves, but almost now they're almost kind of, well, we're going to prove how good and tough we are militarily by doing this. I almost wonder if, because your mention of Afghanistan and the Soviet Union with its superior military fighting a guerrilla war, 20 years later they leave in disaster. We came in right after 9/11, and in a couple months' time we got rid of them, the Taliban and so on. And we were thinking, wow, this is we just know how to do it right. And that kind of macho, we can lick anybody, you try that, and it worked in Iraq, obviously. But what do you do the day after you get rid of them? But
it didn't work in Afghanistan.
No,
you just left, and you
left
with a big mess.
That's right.
And now all the other forces of the world are there trying to clean that up, and they're in a disaster area.
And that's, again, his point about after World War II, we rebuilt Europe with the Marshall Plan, and we did reach out, and Afghanistan, well, we got to get some more important things, like shooting people. Where are we going to fight now? Because there's nobody else to shoot in Afghanistan. I don't mean that the way it sounds, but we do have the general who was quoted, I think I quoted him the other day, once saying how it was fun to kill these guys. And there's a certain bit of, I think in the civilian part of the military, there are lots of people who think, hey, we just need more firepower, we can do it. And in Afghanistan, we did the military attack, and then we left it to them to sort out. And that's where we could be using the rebuilding. I'm sorry.
About a week ago, I think we had two plans before in Congress, Democratic plans, I think, to set deadlines for leaving, which failed. Now I've been gone for a while. I'm sure there's nothing new on that. But how will we pursue that? Are the Democrats going to actually try to get some sort of definitive answer, or is that sort of by the wayside now?
I'll comment on the politics there right now. I get the sense that a lot of Democrats in Congress are eager to start moving things out because they sense public opinion is getting more and more angry and disgusted at it. But again, some major Democratic leaders are very, the ones who seem to be running for president, the Kerrys and the Clintons and so on, seem to be, oh, we don't want to set any deadlines, we don't want to look like we're soft on something. And so I don't picture that passing in the next few months, but I, again, depending on what happens in November and depending what's happening in the war, I think people are, the first comments comparing this to Vietnam and the quagmire and so on, oh, well, there have only been 200 people killed in Iraq, 200 American soldiers, and now it's 2,500, and it's a lot less than Vietnam, but it's still same direction.
And 2,500 is a small number compared to the Iraqis.
Oh, I know.
But we're not counting them.
It is interesting because some people have said that this woman who was, the individual woman who was trying to count Iraqi civilian deaths before she was killed in a bomb about a year ago, Marla something. I don't know if you're familiar with her. Anyway, she did find out that the U.S. was counting. They were keeping track of it. They were not publicizing it. They won't let it out, yeah. But that's, the first thing you do is recognize the other human lives are important enough that we're going to count them.
Yeah, I'm concerned about the kind of unintentional violence peace issues that have resulted by taking reserve and National Guard guys over. Because we're dealing with that now in the congregations with some of these guys coming back just unable to make the adjustment back to civilian life. And so that's a right here in our own community kind of thing. And certainly a lot of these guys got blindsided, never expecting to be into prolonged or repeated deployment in combat.
Well, that's part of National Guard recruiting. You're going to serve your fellow citizens and pay your way through college and some other things, and all of a sudden they're gone for a year. And repeated deployments of some, I think the Guard is stretched very thin, and that also raises the issues about what happens in the states during Hurricane Katrina and other things when you could use a National Guard.
But we're dealing with very angry guys. Generally, it's men that I'm aware of, and people that we're working with, and marriages breaking up, and just people not being able to switch out of combat mode. And I know Minnesota is trying to just address this directly, but do you know if there's any other programs around the nation to help reintegrate people?
There are two things. One, I mean, military is trying a lot of these things, and a lot of states and Congress, they always talk about how we're concerned about our soldiers and our returning soldiers. I had a little talk this morning where I quoted a woman who worked at the Minnesota Veterans Home, which is a nursing home for veterans, and how shameful the care they get is. There's a lot of rhetoric about it. We constantly, oh, let's give tax breaks to military folks, but in terms of the human services, in terms of the psychological counseling, in terms of everything else, there's a lot more talk about how we're going to do all those things in very little actual work on it. I mean, I think that's true in Washington and in the states. There's a lot of sympathy for doing it, and I think the public does, but that costs money, and we're cutting taxes in the middle of a war, which is a new experience.
And you keep hearing talk about we want to keep the war over there and not here, but I guess the families I'm dealing with, the war is coming back home.
Do you work with them? I mean, you said through your church, you work with them?
Actually, I'm pastor of a church, and I have a guy in the congregation who had an extremely difficult adjustment after Vietnam, and he's continued to work with veterans now, and he's now seeing this new crop coming in, and we've been trying to figure out what particular resources the church has that maybe aren't available, from healing services to, you know, just prayers, whatever we can pull out that is different and unique to the church setting. But I guess they keep saying the big problem is that people come back on planes and they come back so quickly they don't have time to make an adjustment, and then instead of continuing on in a military unit where people have had the same experience, they're just dropped off into the main street and among people who have no clue.
Remember after the Vietnam War, I'm wondering if others have sensed the same thing. After Vietnam War, where people came back and were ridiculed as being, I mean, as doing the wrong thing by serving in Vietnam. And at the beginning of this war, I think a lot of people said, well, we're not going to make that mistake again. We're going to honor them. But while they haven't been attacked for going there, we've done nothing more than the rhetoric of we're honoring them, but I don't know, maybe other communities have.
We had a really interesting comment come back about that, because so many people will see someone in uniform and they will say, thank you for your bravery or thank you for your heroism or something like that. And this guy says, the problem is that some of these things you were talking about, the sights you've seen, and maybe the things that you have unintentionally done do not feel very heroic to you, and now you feel more like a fraud than ever when people thank you for that. Mm-hmm. And he said, if you see a soldier, just say thank you for serving your country, and don't presume that they feel like heroes or anything, because it may just be
that's an interesting point.
Wound.
Has anybody else had any experiences with returning veterans about this? I'm curious, because I can picture that reaction. The one guy that quoted that Newsweek interviewed was saying, yeah, he talked further about how some guys, he claimed, and Newsweek pointed out, you know, this is a very disgruntled person coming back, understandably disgruntled, but he claimed that soldiers in firefights would stick their legs out of Humvees so that they might get a non-fatal wound so they could be sent home. And again, the change since Vietnam, I mean, back, they said World War II, I mean, what percentage of soldiers who were injured on the battlefield would live? In Vietnam, it was a little better than that. Now it's like 10 times as many of the wounded are surviving. I mean, much higher return, but the psychological damage is all there. I'm just curious. It's helpful. Where's your church?
Miltona.
Other comment on that direction?
Well, I don't want to redirect. I think that's a really important issue, but I think kind of on a broader scale, not just within our country.
Go ahead.
I want to know what our purpose tonight is for us. Is it to better understand the situation? Is it to propose some plan that we can propose to Bush that'll fix everything? Or is it, and this is what I would like, to figure out what I can do as an American citizen to enhance peace in the world, because I'm not in Congress,
right,
and I'm not capable of doing anything on a big scale. So what can I, as an individual, do to further peace?
And that's a very good point, because we can't change foreign policy. We're not going to, as a group here tonight, propose something that comes out of this. That doesn't mean we shouldn't be talking with elected officials and telling them what you feel, and telling them why you feel what's not working is not working, what solutions you have. But part of what we do want is, I think the reason people come to Holden is to come ideas on how they can do things. And I'm not sure this forum will have a lot of ideas on that. Again, the talk, don't want to keep referring to it, but she's continuing them. Nellie's talks on the Islamic Christian dialogue, and she talked about how comparing the religious faiths, we're past that stage. They have to get people brought together and start building friendships and breaking down the hatred between religions. Because I mean, if this turns into a world war, it's going to be a religious war. At least it seems to me.
Yeah, there's something about this war that is kind of an out of sight, out of mind kind of experience. And speaking to what you're asking about, Jody talked about it this afternoon, and I think in the Holden newsletter that went out, they had an interview with a Christian peacemaker, and it's the simplest things. It's hard for Americans to think of just doing very simple things. We have to do things big,
complicated,
and
big
important things, right? But the simple thing is to hear people's story, that's to go against the out of sight. Out how easy it is for us to be, you know, to have the war and its experience be something over there. That only one person in this room raised their hand when you asked, you know, do you have any contact with somebody, a veteran who's been, you know, affected by the war directly? And so, you know, taking opportunities, be in situations where you basically hear people's story from other parts of the world. That's work that I do, and it keeps it more real for me. But even then, it's still, you know, it's still very much out of sight, out of mind.
It's interesting, the woman, your comments back there about not counting the Iraqi casualties. Right. A lot of the things that are happening in this war seem to be done in a way to keep it out of mind, partly because you lose political support for a war when you have unpleasant things like that. And that, the refusal to count, at least publicly count, the fatalities of civilians, the refusal to, which they've kind of backed away from, the actual decision not to allow any photographs of caskets coming back to our country. I mean, how do you honor people by saying, oh, we can't show you any pictures of it? They're coming back in caskets, and the more, that's exactly right. If we don't know about it, we don't think about it.
Well, there's a girl, did you see on the news, it was a couple weeks ago, about the 15-year-old girl who made that video clip and put it on the internet about, to the song, Jesus Loves Me, This I Know. She has children singing it, and she has pictures of Iraqi children that are killed in coffins, and it's really made a big impact.
Who did this? Where was it?
A 15-year-old girl somewhere. I can't remember where. Somewhere in the U.S. Just a kid. And she's gotten hate mail. She's gotten all kinds of, but also positive support. She's been on a lot of news channels. So there's a big polarity in this country that if you're against the Iraq war in any way, you hate this country, you're non-patriotic, you don't support the troops, you don't support Bush. There's a big, so she's receiving a lot of hate. She's gotten death threats for doing this. And it's just, all it is the song and pictures of the people who have
pictures
died.
Pictures of time.
And children. Yeah.
Again, that brings the war close to home for people.
And they don't want to see it.
Yeah.
They don't want to see it.
In response to your question, I just think that people that are late teens in their 20s have to get more active. They have to have more peace marches. They have to march in Washington. They, you know, One thing that was organized in Seattle, a high school organized just a big awareness march for what's going on in Darfur. And I took my kids there, and they didn't get near as involved as I would have liked them to, but at least they got exposed. And these were young people organizing this, and they marched on our federal building in Seattle and, you know, got some attention and got some other people involved. But there aren't enough, you know, young people, I think, being active enough. There, you know, things that we did and things that happened in the 60s, except for Sheehan, something like that, that sort of got things going for a while outside Bush's ranch last year. But I just feel like that young people need to be getting more actively involved, the ones who do, you know, feel that way.
Again, Darfur, you don't have issues like Darfur if the world is aware of situations like genocidal situations, if the world's aware of them, I mean, well, we're aware, yeah, we know it's happening, we knew what was happening in Rwanda, but we kind of turned away from it. So the more we can, young people get involved in that, the better. Elsa.
Along with the action, I think it's really important to educate yourself and educate others, because it's really easy to make it into a very simplistic, we're right, they're wrong kind of thing. And if you want to engage people in dialogue, you have to try to understand where they're coming from and what's motivating them and their actions. So for example, what is motivating people who want to continue? I mean, looking at the war in Iraq, people with whom we might disagree with on this, what is the motivation there? And how do we talk to them? How do we remain civil? I think that's often a big problem. And so in addition to the action, getting out there and doing things, people of all ages, not just young people, we also need to know the facts, to educate ourselves, and then to talk to people, to take that time and have those conversations that aren't easy to do.
I've thought for a while that one thing that could be done, this is a little more like Elsa's saying rather than an idea for action, is repentance, both individually and as a nation. In other words, I think U.S. oftentimes is like, okay, how do we get out of this? Or what is the next step? Or, you know, fighting about some tactic. Whereas if we think about where we came from and how we got there, we may actually begin addressing you know, some of the real systemic problems and the idea of that relying on violence isn't always the best thing. And just by saying, acknowledging we made a mistake and that we're sorry for what we have caused, you know, that can open up all sorts of things. You're talking about dialogue or whatever those sort of things are doing. And it seems to me to be something that we're almost, as a country, and even all of us as people that are part of this democracy and have elected and gone along with policies, are incapable of doing. And we always want to be right.
Yeah. Arrogance is not a good way to build dialogue. And I do think that, I mean, that's part of the problem we have. By religion or nationality, when you have people, we're the good guys, we're doing the right thing, you're not getting any dialogue when you're having people just brag about how good they are and how vilifying the other side, which we have to do. I don't know, Elks or you or somebody was just saying a couple minutes ago about, yeah, we've got an increasingly polarized country, and you have to, we don't speak for our country, we speak for ourselves, and how do we collectively change the direction our country's headed if we don't feel right about it? Jody.
One quick thing yet, and a political observation. Two of the most moving days in my life in the last few years occurred on the first anniversary of 9/11, and then they did another one on the second anniversary, and it was the major metropolitan community organizing group in the Chicago area who reached out to Protestant Catholic denominations and the Jewish community on the one hand and the Council of Islamic Congregations on the other, and simply brought 1,500 people together, 500 Muslims and 1,000 Christians and Jews, for about 5 hours of food and dialogue on Navy Pier in Chicago, and sat them at tables and got them to tell each other the stories, who they were, and it at least for the people who were there both years, made an immense difference. And I think it, for people who are in communities where there is a sizable Muslim population, or at least any Muslim population, just bringing people together to tell each other stories, it's not a political agenda, it's just let's get to know each other a little bit, and it makes a huge difference.
It's interesting, yours is the community organizer and Nellie's conversations is the faculty person in that issue. Both of you are saying the same thing, yeah, bringing people together not to talk about religion but to talk about everything else.
That's right, who they are. One quick political observation, and John, just for a second here. I think one of our difficulties here is that we have had a regime, let me just get a little partisan here, for the last 5 years, who really are dominated by people who don't believe in government except for its military form. That their primary idea about what a government is for is that it's a military operation, whether it's foreign or domestic. they operate that way domestically as well. And almost every other possible function, public good, in the government is not something that they value. So that all of the other stuff on your agenda about winning hearts and minds is getting cut. Peace Corps is constantly getting cut. The domestic variation on that, AmeriCorps and VISTA, is constantly getting cut. And so I think one of our problems is to reclaim an idea of public service and government, which somehow is beyond the military. And I'm not sure that this particular group is one that could get that.
Yeah, they clearly don't believe in those things.
They don't. And it's why Katrina, by the way, happened, right?
Yeah.
If you get people who don't believe in government, running government, you're going to get the result that Katrina.
And then when government doesn't do it right because they didn't, then they blame government. See, proves
that's
government
right.
Didn't work.
Yeah.
How about if we were to take a different tack on that and use the military for peaceful hearts and mind winning approach? Say, at least some analysis suggests that our problem both in Vietnam and now in Iraq is that we haven't used enough troops. So how about if Christians really started pushing for, say, 1 million troops to go into Iraq from whatever countries are willing to do that? Some obviously to deal with terrorism, but mostly to rebuild infrastructure and forget about the sham democracy building stuff and actually help the people on a massive scale. Wouldn't that win hearts and minds in uniforms? That should please Republicans and accomplish other purposes from the rest of us as well.
I think that's somewhat what people were hoping was going to happen, because again, yeah.
Oh, we don't have enough troops there for that.
But also now I think it's at the stage where you're in American uniform, and it's not like they remember they were going to be received as conquering heroes. And I think it's at the stage now where you have too many cases of too much anger and so on that, I mean, I really think that they are becoming a problem themselves just because they're there in uniform and what seems to be watching now when Bush said it that on the aircraft carrier, bring them on. You're going to come pick off our soldiers. Well, they've been doing it. I mean, they did come on, and they did one here, one there, and I mean, I don't know how you get around that, because if they're shooting at you, it's pretty hard to do so. I think it'd be great. I think that would have been the best thing the military could have done, would be step in and do it, but I don't know if you could do that now.
I want nuanced conversation about this, but I also realize that we need succinct language to fight the barrage of slogans like cut and run. Maybe troops for peace is... So I think it's difficult when people are using language like cut and run, and you want to have a nuanced conversation that you get tongue-tied. And so I like what you just said about troops for peace. There was some of that with no blood for oil. But I do think we need a message to counteract the message that people that want to continue the war are so skilled at perpetuating.
Just a comment from an outsider, from a Canadian perspective. I mean, I look at, you know, the American people, and they're talking about, you know, you talk about cut and run. When I remember when before the war started, and the ambassador to the United States came to Canada, and he talked to us, and, you know, you're our best friends. How can you not support us? And you know, it made me angry. In that, do best friends always agree with each other? I mean, don't they try and reprimand or
counsel them? Maybe.
I mean, I thought that's what friends were for. But also, once now that you've gone in and you've removed a regime, even though it may have been evil and wrong. Now you've created this vacuum that's there. There's nothing to fill that vacuum. So now you're just going to leave. And what's going to happen then? I mean, I just can't see how that could be an option for a country that's gone against really all of world opinion, other than a few select nations. I mean, it was the whole world said, don't go in there. Now you're in this position.
Yeah. Just on that point, I think it's interesting that, like, Americans as well know that, like you say, other countries are involved. Like, I'm from Australia, and we're fighting in the war also. And it has implications on other countries. And I think it's a big risk. Like, the U.S. has a huge responsibility, but I think it's also interesting to note that responsibility falls on other countries as well. Like, our economy, like, you know, it's connected. It makes an impact and a ripple effect, not just against people, but people who are also helping and aiding the U.S. And also on, like, the comment about what can you do, kind of like a grassroots kind of personal thing. Like, being an exchange student has been so eye-opening, because I've kind of realize that not only meeting Americans, but meeting other exchange students from all around the world, it's kind of, you see that people are the same. Like, how you were saying that the Muslim and Christians in Chicago, how they came together, I think it's just been really life-changing just to sort of see firsthand that, you know, we all breathe the same air, as you've heard, you know, you've probably heard that saying so many times, but like, even if you struck up, like, a pen pal or an e-pal, you know, like, little things like that, just to get a bit more of a world view, I think helps in your own personal understanding, maybe. I don't know if it's just an idea, but I know for myself personally, it's just really changed how I see, yeah, people, like, in communities. So. And it's a learning thing, too. Like, it's also challenging at the same time because you have your own pride, like we all do, in our own countries. So it's really, it's also a challenge to sort of see that, you know, things aren't right or wrong, but they're different, you know what I mean? That's kind of a saying that I have to keep on reminding myself.
And our country does have to watch it because in the last few years we've really cut back on foreign students coming here. The point even, big controversy a year ago or so about the Islamic scholar coming to Notre Dame who was kept out of the country because fear that he was, I mean, this is the moderate Muslim that you want to have teaching here. And we're shutting out a lot of foreign students. Our universities are talking about how they've had so much trouble with students who were coming here, having trouble getting the chance to keep coming. But again, your point is right. The more we can expand dialogue, the better. Yes,
the better. I had the privilege a year and a half ago to go to South Africa. And I have a couple of thoughts about that. One of the books that we read in preparation for going is the book No Future Without Forgiveness by Desmond Tutu. And it strikes me that maybe a good place to begin a conversation about world peace would be to require every one of our elected officials to have to read that book. just because it gives a model that there's another way other than going and beating up. Yes, okay, so you've got the models of many other countries too, but this is a very current model, and this was a very difficult and tough one, and the issue, the language of forgiveness has been incredibly powerful. But another layer of that is this getting to know people of other countries. I think something that the ELCA does that we could work on doing better, at least in some parts of the country than we have, is our Companion Synod piece. Because within the Companion Synod piece, we are working on helping ordinary people in our country get to know ordinary people in another part of the world.
Are others familiar with this? I'm not familiar with this ELCA. Go ahead, briefly explain it, yeah.
Companion Synod is a thing where, you know, the ELCA is divided up into 65, I think it is, synods to make governing easier. And so we have taken, and for instance, I'm in the Southwestern Minnesota Synod. We have requested to be assigned to a synod in another part of the world, kind of like you have sister cities. We have brother or sister synods back and forth. And the goal is to get to know one another, to break that down into smaller so you can have a congregation relationship. But I find it so interesting and troubling how difficult it is to stir up in people a desire to even get to know just ordinary people in another country. And to, you know, we work and we rack our brains to brainstorm. Now, how can we just get people to have a little bit of interest? But if we don't get interest in ordinary people in other places, that storytelling, I don't know how we deal with in Iraq. I think peace begins not just in war areas, but it's as we hear stories from all over.
Go ahead, Paul.
Oh, I like that story because we live in the poorest county in Wisconsin, and our Northwest Synod of Wisconsin is a companion synod of Malawi, which is one of the poorest countries in Africa. And it is a person-to-person thing. One of our kindergarten teachers in our town, who is one of the most difficult people in the Western Hemisphere, went to Malawi 2 years ago, and it changed her life, just a person-to-person exchange. And this last spring, when we were back there, our church hosted the choir from the
Cathedral, Lutheran Cathedral in Malawi, and it opened up so many stories, as you say. I don't think most people in Pepin County had ever heard of Malawi prior to the Companion Synod piece. I don't think most people in this room have heard of Malawi. I mean, it just doesn't come to mind when you have to name countries. That's more on him. And to have little towns in Wisconsin supporting feeding stations in Malawi, which is overrun with AIDS and the consequences of that, it's a beautiful thing. Does that mean that those people changed people from being supporting the war in Iraq or something? I don't know. We have 5 families who sent people to Iraq twice in our congregation, so there's a lot of distrust.
Those are certainly good long-term things, because I think one of the reasons we get this problem of nationalism, arrogance kind of thing, is because we don't have much of that, and keep thinking how many other countries have, from early elementary grades on, foreign language study, and how a lot of our districts, for money or whatever reason, don't teach languages till high school, and then it's 2 or 3 choices.
Jane. I know I've taught some English as second language, and one of my ladies was from Iraq, and I know that I have a much better understanding of Iraq, and she has a better understanding of America. So we've got to know each other and talked and things, and it's a small way.
And it all adds up.
Something you can do to become more aware of the Companion Synod relationship is by going to the ELC website and downloading their Prayer Ventures, which is a devotional, something that's the monthly devotional thing that you can use in your devotions, that often there are references to their synod relationships between the church here and churches over in other countries. And we've used it for a number of years now, and it's incorporated into our devotion time every day.
One question I'll throw in, and then I'll take a couple more over there. When we're talking about all of these things, the people who are involved in the Companion Synod thing, the people who are involved in foreign exchange programs, tend to be people who may already be sensitive to this, and one of the issues is we've got a very divided country where some people don't want to talk to others. Welcome any reflections on that as well. But over there,
this is a bit of a jump ship, but it is sort of nuts that we're fighting this war for a substance that is killing the environment. And so energy has to be part of the discussion too. And so one of my little measly things is I'm trying to, and I haven't put pen to paper yet, and I will do that, but try to drive fewer miles every year. I don't really care what mileage my car gets. If it stays in the garage, it's a good car. And my sons are going to have licenses, and so the number of miles our family drives could potentially go up a lot. And so that's going to be a focus.
And there are federal policies on that where we refuse to even talk about higher energy efficiency standards.
But I haven't been driving at all since I've been here.
I just want to say that. It's just those bus drivers, they're the problem.
I have a 30-year-old who just bought a diesel truck, and he's got a little sign on the back of it. He runs it only on biodiesel, and it says biodiesel, no war required.
Well, along the same lines, part of our military policy, or the way we've used the military, is to protect our interests worldwide. And a lot of that is to sustain or grow our standard of living. And the question was asked, what can we do as individuals to counter that? And I think one way would be to look at how do you reduce your standard of living so that we don't need the military to go out there and protect.
Yeah.
So it keeps coming in. And then the flip side is, if you look at people in other countries, no wonder they hate us. I mean, we're on top, we spend arrogantly, we take whatever we want.
And we spend money we don't have.
And they don't, they are struggling to eat.
I thought it was ironic when after September 11th, the number one suggestion our government gave us for what to do is shop.
Yeah.
And then during a war where we're spending hundreds of billions a year now, the solution is let's cut taxes, because the idea, I was just came across something the other day about gas rationing in World War II, and not because we had gas shortage, rubber shortage, we didn't want to wear out the tires. Keep thinking, we asked people to do all kinds of sacrifices in war, and now we're asking people to spend more.
Mm-hmm.
And give more taxes back, because we don't need government to do anything. Any more on that? We've got a few more minutes yet. You can go a different direction if you want to. Go ahead.
I just want to say that I think fear has played a big part in the protest movement in the United States not really getting started. And I know that, you know, I feel like I'm being watched when I send emails out. I mean, it's just a feeling. You know, but it's creates a resistance that I feel like I'm, you know, fighting myself. I'm opening myself up to, you know, possibilities of being investigated or losing my job for, you know, just coming to a meeting like this.
With that Drake University thing a year or two ago, where they were taking down, they wanted the school to turn over the names of everybody who came to some peace meeting. I mean, it was something like this. Well, we want to know all the names. I keep thinking that went out with the McCarthy era.
That's
but
not new. That's McCarthy. That's Vietnam.
That's right. It comes back, and it's scary to see that. I'm curious if anybody else noticed this too. Remember how we used to have the orange, red, yellow alerts? I don't know which was highest. Red, I guess, was. They really disappeared after the last election. I don't think we've had two warnings since then, and they were every week until then. But the fear is, you're right, it's a driving force.
Well, in that regard, I want to go back to Peter's comment, you know, and your comment earlier about language and, you know, the courage that it would take for, as a country, much less as individuals, for us to actually talk about repenting for what we've done in this war. You know, because that's the thing that Rove and company are trying to get at with the cut and run thing, is to say, we are, you know, you want to be a bunch of cowards? You know, well, we're Americans, we're not cowards, right? So if we could reframe courage and bravery as being able to repent as a way of kind of turning that one around, it seems to me it also, it gets to the fear piece, because the best way of fighting fear is to be courageous, right? I mean, to do something as an act of courage. The places, I mean, it seems to me the place where ideally that would happen would be in some kind of situation where we could, you know, you were talking about the South African experience, is to be able to, you know, repent with the victims, you know, to find this young, you know, I mean, obviously not this girl per se that you were reading about, but to find situations where we could connect with people who have been victims of our sins, our misdeeds, and do the kind of thing that they did in South Africa, the Truth and Reconciliation and so forth, that we prepare for that. And I don't know, you know, in that case it was a quasi-governmental entity. I don't know whether we would ever be able to have a government that would have that courage, but maybe institutions like the church could create those kind of forums where that kind of exchange could occur.
That one woman I referred to earlier, maybe some of you know her name, Marla Rusnik or something, who was killed in a bomb in Iraq. She was a 27-year-old young woman or something. When she was killed, Pat Leahy in the U.S. Senate said in 30 years he's met all kinds of impressive people. He'd never met somebody like her. Her whole point was in Iraq was going and meeting with the victims' family members and getting to know them, impressing the military to, because there was some sort of program set up to compensate families, pressing the military to take its responsibility on that. I mean, that's exactly the kind of thing you're saying. She's was one person doing it with a small organization, but if we could get churches, I mean, I don't think we're at that stage yet where a country would do that, partly because of the macho, we're not chicken, we're not cowards, we don't cut and run. But maybe the church, maybe some other groups could do that in a period of time from now.
I think we have an obligation, at the very least, to vote and to take a political stand so that we have a voice, so we're not completely helpless, and to get this government out.
And that maybe, is there any, you asked, well, we got about a minute or two left, does anybody else, one last comment here?
Just something this young lady said, and over here too, I think education is just so important. I've had some experience in the Middle East, I wish I was a lot more educated than I was, but when 9/11 happened, which I think was 100% wrong that it happened, but also, you have to start thinking right away, why did it happen? And our government stance right away was the vengeance, let's go get them. There wasn't a lot of official explanation of why people feel this way toward us and why we're just breeding more and more, in quotes, terrorists. We're breeding more young men in the Middle East to hate the United States. It's not going to end with our generation. And part of the education, what they did on Navy Pier in Seattle, the day after 9/11, the Islam mosques opened for the public to come in, and there was a lot of dialogue. My sister, my kids, and I all went. A lot of people, you know, brought flowers and things like that. But at Seattle Center, there was a big gathering, and in the mosque, dialogue explaining, not making an excuse, this is why it's happening.
Right.
Because there was no excuse, but still informing people and giving some reasons and how we can make sure it not happen again, other than let's just go kill the few people who organized it and then think that everything's going to be okay. So education is just a really important part.
And I think on that note, we do have some opportunity. There are some good things like that happened. I think the Islamic community in the U.S. was reaching out to others in Minnesota. There's still fruit that's been being born from what happened right afterwards, where the Islamic community reached out and Christian, other religious communities reached out to them. And there's some lasting relationships from that. There are plenty of positive things happening that way. I guess it suggests we have to do a lot more of that. And to the young woman who is asking what she can do, I hope this discussion tonight has stimulated some thoughts and some ideas on how maybe we can each do a little bit more to bring us towards the direction of peace, because we're certainly, I think it's fair to say, the world is a lot more dangerous than it was right after 9/11, and we better turn it around as quick as we can. We all have to do that. So, I think this was a good discussion. Appreciate your participating. Thank you.